I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A cyber attack has infiltrated Fortune 500 companies and state and federal government agencies and has been called the largest act of espionage in U.S. history. The breach occurred months ago, revealing serious vulnerabilities in the country's cyber defense system. While Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and intelligence officials have blamed Russia for the attack, President Trump has blamed China and privately called the attack a hoax. President-elect Biden, speaking in Wilmington earlier this month, said his administration would impose substantial costs on those responsible. Here's an edited clip from his December 22nd speech.
The truth is this. The Trump administration failed to prioritize cybersecurity. In an age when so much of our lives are conducted online, cyber attacks must be treated as a serious threat. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch. But rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will.
On the show today, the latest on the hack and how the U.S. should respond. Our guest is Nicole Perlroff, and she covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for The New York Times. She's also the author of a forthcoming book titled This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, and it's about global cyber arms race. And Nicole Perlroff got up really early. She joins us from San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. There's so many questions I have for you, but let's begin with Russia. Is there definitive proof that Russia was behind this attack?
So what we know is, from the private sector at least, what we know is that this was beyond the means of any cyber criminal group. It was so sophisticated that it was beyond the sophistication of anything FireEye, a security company that first flagged the attack, had seen. And intelligence agencies have been briefing Congress that they think it is a very specialized group of elite hackers within Russia's intelligence called the SVR. And unfortunately, they haven't offered any public proof of that. But that is sort of the latest to come out of these intelligence briefings.
And if we, again, there's so much we don't know, but if SVR is behind this attack, is Putin behind SVR? Can we say that this was in any way orchestrated by President Putin of Russia?
Very much so. What we learned actually through the election was that this went right up to the very top, and that with these espionage operations, with some of these hack and leak operations, the intelligence community believes it was personally directed by Putin. In this case, when you look back at what the SVR has hacked in prior cases, mm-hmm. they were one of the groups that actually was inside the DNC as well. They were not the group that was in charge with the hack and leak. They were more of these sort of quiet prowlers that were moving around some of the DNC systems, some of the state registration systems, but never did anything with them. They also had come up previously in similar espionage campaigns on the State Department and the White House, and those aren't targets that at least intelligence analysts believe these units would go hack on sort of a rogue basis. They believe that this goes right up to the very top of the Kremlin.
But it's so interesting that it includes local state government agencies, the federal government itself, and also Fortune mm-hmm. 500 companies. I mean, that's such a broad spectrum of targets.
Well, what's interesting with that is the way they did it. So the way they did it was they hacked into this company called SolarWinds that most customers actually didn't even realize they used until the past few weeks when we learned of this breach. They're based in Austin. What they do is they just give IT administrators visibility into their networks, what cloud services they're using, what devices are attached to it, what applications have been downloaded. And at this point, we know that they got into this company and they compromised the software update that made its way to all these customers. So SolarWinds itself has said that this update, that was basically a Russian backdoor, made its way to something like 18,000 targets. Wow. But of those, they believe that the SVR only went after the highest value targets among them, which includes some of these government agencies, and then, you know, some of these companies in the Fortune 500. And also, we know a lot of IT security companies. So they didn't go and hack all 18,000, but they could have. And we know that maybe with the access they had, with the sort of incredible access that they would have had, they didn't want to burn that access. So they just zeroed in on the targets that would have been of most use to them.
And largely until recently undetected by, let's say, the federal government. I mean, we've spent billions of dollars on a cyber defense system, and they were caught unawares.
Yeah, that really is the most stunning fact of this hack so far. You know, we only know about it because FireEye, the security company that first detected a hack on its own network, suspected that somehow this had come in through the supply chain. And the more they dug in, the more they realized it had come through SolarWinds. And so they fired off an alert and said, hey, we've been hacked. Here's what we believe was stolen. And then a few days later, they said, actually, we think it came through SolarWinds. And right away, we saw CISA, which is the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity arm, send out a directive for all federal civilian agencies to unplug SolarWinds. And since then, it's just been this feverish game by Department of Homeland Security, by intelligence agencies, to find out just how broad and deep this attack went. But you're right. I mean, we have pursued sort of a two-pronged strategy when it comes to our cyber defense. One is to get this system that they call Einstein installed at every federal civilian agency. Einstein is known just to look for known bad stuff, you know, malware, you know, IP addresses that we know belong to bad actors or adversaries, and block them. A second system called CDM, which is just short for, I think, continuous detection and mitigation, is supposed to look for some sort of unusual activity on these networks. And these were not cheap, and they were not cheap to install. And the Department of Homeland Security was charged with making sure that this was rolled out across federal agencies, and it didn't detect anything. So that's one giant failure. But the other is that intelligence agencies did not detect this. So one of the things, and this has really been a high priority for General Paul Nakasone, who runs NSA and its sort of military cousin, U.S. Cyber Command at the Pentagon. His strategy is something that he calls defend forward, which basically means hack into the adversary, hack into Russian networks, hack into Chinese networks, Iranian networks, so that we can get an early alert on what they are doing, what they are planning, who they are hacking, and what they are doing that with, so that they know what's coming for us and can sort of take the fight to the adversary's networks if need be. Now, in this case, apparently they had no clue what the SVR was up to, and I think that is the thing that really has rattled government officials.
And raising a whole host of questions. I mean, was it just not recognizing or perhaps the sophistication of the Russian hack just sort of outpaced our ability to find it?
Well, there's a couple theories right now. One is that we were so hyper-focused on defending the election for the last year that perhaps we over-tilted in focusing on the election without realizing that, oh, actually, they've come for our federal agencies. That's one theory. You know, another is just that because they came in through the software supply chain, we just weren't looking in the right places. And there's been some talk of trying to secure the U.S. supply chain over the past few years. There's actually a working group at the Department of Homeland Security that just sent out, ironically, an update last week on how vulnerable our supply chain is.
Oh, wow.
but there hasn't been meaningful, clearly, there hasn't been meaningful change in how we're vetting these systems. And one of the things I just find fascinating is you know, SolarWinds is one of these cloud services that sort of came in 10 years ago. They were founded 20 years ago, but they really pioneered this approach that just went direct to IT administrators. So if an IT administrator wanted better visibility of their networks, they could download SolarWinds at a price point that really kind of went just below the corporate threshold for approval. So they would download it, and that's part of the reason it's deployed so widely is, you know, this is just staff downloaded this thing, and it gave them broad access and visibility to their networks. It also had broad access to their servers and networks. So a lot of the victims that we've spoken to over the past few weeks didn't even know they had had SolarWinds deployed on their networks until it was breached, which to me is really kind of a stunning aspect of this.
Do we know, did they steal data? Did they, you know, corrupt data? Did they just want to sow confusion and doubt about our systems that we're all so reliant on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, if there's any good news to this, and there really isn't much, it is that this is the SVR, and we know the SVR to be, like I said earlier, kind of these quiet prowlers. There are other groups, particularly within the GRU, that have done serious destruction, particularly in Ukraine. You know, they've shut the power grid off for 6 hours in the dead of winter back in, I think it was 2015. They, you know, held systems ransom in 2017 with a giant attack that cost companies billions of dollars, and companies are still trying to recover what was lost. Even American companies like Pfizer and FedEx were hit in that attack. And so clearly they didn't show much restraint. But the SVR is different. It really is sort of a traditional espionage group. Now, the question is, so what was their goal? You know, was it to steal data? And we don't know exactly, or at least we haven't heard or been able to confirm exactly what was stolen beyond what was stolen from the initial victim, FireEye. But we're trying to find that out, and that's sort of the question everyone is trying to answer right now. But, you know, one thing that intelligence officials and government officials we've spoken to are really worried about is we have no idea what they did once they got in right now. We don't know how many back doors they've planted. This is a group that has been traditionally, at least from what we know from the 2014-2015 hacks they did at the State Department and White House, really very difficult to eradicate. When I talk to people who were involved in just getting them out of those networks back in 2015, they described it as hand-to-hand digital combat. I mean, wow. The SVR would take over some of the tools they were using to investigate. So really, we just don't know how far into these systems they've gotten.
Let's take a very short break. That's Nicole Perlroth, and she covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times. We're talking about the hack that came to light. And we've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap what we're talking about. A massive cyber attack penetrated government and private sector computer networks this year, and it's being called the largest act of espionage in U.S. history. We're talking about the latest on the hack, what we know, what we don't know, what could have been stolen or compromised, what kind of national security threat it poses, and later we'll be talking about how the U.S. should respond. And again, our guest is Nicole Perlroth. She covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times, author of a forthcoming book titled This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? Nicole, I wanted to go back just to the fact that these hackers from SVR, as you describe, were able to penetrate our very complicated and interconnected computer systems. But does it also tell us just how much more sophisticated the Russians are than America? And should we, as just private citizens, be worried that somehow our data is at risk?
It's a great question. So I think I'll take the second one first. I think
sure.
We as private citizens should not be as worried. This is not a group that comes after private citizens. They're really sort of an NSA-level espionage operation. Now, in terms of what they stole and what they're planning on doing with it, I think that is going to be one of the biggest questions for the new administration. Yeah. I mean, Mr. Joe Biden is coming in a way where he can no longer trust government networks. He can't trust that these networks are not compromised with Russian backdoors. That is a huge problem. And maybe, and you asked a great question earlier, maybe that was the point of this operation, sort of seed doubt. But that would be sort of the best case scenario. Worst case scenario, we're talking about a situation where everything that these agencies do on their unclassified networks is potentially compromised. Now, some have said, they didn't get into the classified networks, and that's right. Publicly what some of these agencies have said. That is good news. But when you talk to intelligence officials privately, what they'll say is they're very concerned about sensitive but unclassified data that may have been stolen. So one example may be, at the Department of Energy and FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they maintain and do regular updates to something called Black Start, which is a very, very technical blueprint for how the U.S. would restore power in the event of some sort of cataclysmic blackout. Now, if Russia had that list, it would be the perfect hit list of sorts to make sure power was not restored in the United States in, say, the event of a cyber-induced blackout. And that's something that my colleague David Sanger and I have written a lot about sort of the tit-for-tat that has been happening between Russia and the United States about hacking into each other's grid. Not that that's imminent, but it does seem like we are getting to a place of sort of a digital Cold War where both countries are, in essence, preparing the battlefield. Now, in terms of does this Russian hack mean that Russia is more sophisticated than the U.S.? I don't think so. I have to remind myself that when I was pulled into some of the Snowden documents and I was able to go through some of the NSA documents through that project, while most people were horrified to find out that, our nation's premier spy agency was indeed spying, I have to admit I was a little relieved to
really?
See
wow.
just how sophisticated the NSA was. The reason, we're constantly reporting on Chinese attacks and Russian attacks and Iranian attacks and North Korean attacks, but not NSA attacks, isn't because we would not. It's because they are so good at what they do and clearly so stealthy and so sophisticated that security firms aren't able to often unearth what the agencies are doing. So I wouldn't say this means that Russia is, somehow ahead of us, but they're certainly our most formidable adversary in cyberspace. I've heard the president and Bill Barr and others talk about how China is the more formidable adversary we have in cyberspace. And I think part of that is because China has just been so prolific over the last two decades. It's stealing U.S. intellectual property. But always, always, always in the national intelligence assessments, they've always put Russia at the very top in terms of sophistication. And I think what this hack has showed is that they very much understand the soft underbelly of the United States. They know where our weaknesses are. They know where the gaps and seams are, and they know how to get into our systems through those gaps and seams.
Well, and just to underscore what you're saying there, oftentimes I think the way we think about these attacks, whether it was in 2016 on the election or what we're talking about now, we think, well, the U.S. is so vulnerable, and clearly we are. But we do this as well. I just wanted to make sure, Nicole, our listeners understand this, that is that the United States engages in cyber attacks on other countries, including Russia, including Iran, and probably North Korea, another, and maybe probably China as well. I just want to make sure that that point is made.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a really important point to remind people of when we talk about what our potential response would be. Because how do you respond to something that you do yourself is a very interesting question for the United States intelligence agencies right now. But, you know, let's see, I think it was 6 years ago, my colleague David Singer and I reported that, and people forget this when they talk about Huawei, but my colleague and I reported that actually the NSA penetrated Huawei in much the same way that Russia just penetrated SolarWinds. So initially, the reason for that was the NSA was going in to see if there were any Chinese backdoors in Huawei systems. But once they were in, that was a huge intelligence coup for them. Knowing that Huawei was used by China, by a lot of our adversaries, it gave them a way into these systems to spy on our adversaries. So in some ways, it's incredibly similar to the SolarWinds hack, except perhaps that Huawei may be even more widespread than SolarWinds is. And, you know, same with some of the NSA and U.S. attacks we've discovered in Iran. You know, at one point, and this is, you know, important to remember with the SolarWinds attack, at one point, the U.S. and Israel compromised Microsoft software update to get into Iranian computers. And that was just, I remember at Microsoft, engineers just had to convene in this war room and they were just so shocked that their own government would compromise this very trusted mechanism by which Microsoft, one of the biggest technology companies in the world, communicates and gets code out to its customers just to hack a few select targets in Iran. So this is something that we have done for years. This is something we're also very good at. And because we're very good at it, it makes it very difficult to respond to this latest attack as if it is an act of war, because then perhaps if what we are doing is discovered, our adversaries would also reason that that would be an act of war.
Let me get a caller from Germantown to join our conversation. And this is Mike. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much. But it sure seems like your recent comments answered my question, and that is that it is a two-way street and that we're just as good or hopefully as effective as the Russians are. And so this then becomes the equivalent of, you know, the nuclear option, where in the IT, nuclear sure destruction on both sides option. So you, it's kind of nice to, you know, trash talk each other and say, hey, listen, I got in, see that, ha-ha. And then so that we know that if one pulls it, that we actually, it would be just mutual destruction, IT destruction on both sides. So I think that's what your guest is saying, and I'm pleased to hear that we're, you know, that there's no gap in technology between the United States and Russia. We're just as good, or hopefully we're better than they are.
Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, but they were they meaning Russia, apparently, reportedly, Nicole, able to penetrate our computer networks without us knowing.
Yeah, so it is in a way mutually assured destruction in one sense. The problem is, and people don't realize this, that, you know, the U.S. is arguably, if not tied with Israel and Russia and maybe the U.K. and a few others, the most formidable sort of cyber superpower there is. It is also one of the most vulnerable because we are so digitized here. You know, we have been plugging in our critical infrastructure, our oil pipelines, our power grid, our water treatment facilities into the internet for the last few decades without ever pausing to ask ourselves, are we just creating the world's biggest attack surface? And what Russia has on us is that they are not as digitized. So this is a huge problem when you think about calibrating a cyber response, particularly with countries like North Korea, which are barely digitized. You know, they can attack us, and sure, we can attack them too, but we are most vulnerable. And often what happens, and what we've seen this with North Korea and also with Iran, they don't come for the Pentagon. They come for our companies. They come for our economy. You know, Iran came for our banks and took them offline in a months-long attack. So it's very asymmetrical. And unfortunately, just because we're good and Russia's good, we can't just kind of play this game and go back and forth and call it sort of, you know, traditional wink-wink espionage, because unfortunately, where we see the biggest ramifications is usually in the private sector.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Nicole Perlroff, and she covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times. We're talking about the cyber attack that came to light in the last couple of weeks. She's also the author of a forthcoming book titled This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, a very formidable title, if I must say so, Nicole. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Just a quick follow-up here. As you say, we are so digitized in this country. I realize we're the world's superpower, at least as of today. Are there countries that are as digitized as us, but they're just not the target of the kinds of attacks that we're getting?
Such a good question. So the countries I really like to point to are Scandinavia and Japan. So both are hugely digitized countries, right? But they actually have treated security is a top priority from the start. They make it a part of their culture. You know, any corporate training includes training on passwords, on things like two-factor authentication, on really the criticality of being aware of digital threats. And they also have national policies in place that I believe in Japan exacts harsh fines for companies that aren't considered up to snuff when it comes to the security of their critical infrastructure. So there's carrots and sticks that they've put in place. We do not have that here. You know, Congress has really failed, and this is really on Congress. They have failed to pass any meaningful cybersecurity legislation. It always comes down to lobbying groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce arguing that any kind of strict cybersecurity regulation would be too burdensome for the private sector, and consistently it gets watered down. So what legislation we have seen has always come in the form of an executive order. It was an executive order that created CISA, which was the cybersecurity division of the Department of Homeland Security, which has been in the news lately because they were front and center at defending the election, right. And now front and center once again. But we are as digitized as those countries, but we are woefully behind on defense.
Let me get another caller to join our conversation, and this is Ted, and he's calling us from Westchester. Ted, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
With how sophisticated this attack has been, has anyone suggested that it could have been an inside job by the U.S.?
Well, that's an interesting question. Nicole, have you looked into that?
So inside job. So here's what's interesting. When SolarWinds described this attack in their latest SEC filing, they described it in a very unique way that I had not seen previously, which was they called it a manual supply chain attack. And, you know, under questioning, you know, they've not said this out loud, but they've said, well, this is the definition of a manual supply chain attack. A manual supply chain attack, in their definition, is an individual had access to their source code that rolled out in this update. Now, that's all we know. And we don't know if there was sort of a spy embedded in their satellite offices. They do have satellite offices in Eastern Europe. Which is interesting given the adversary we're talking about, but we have no proof of that. But we know, you know, somehow an individual got into their source code. Now, that starts to point to some kind of what they call an insider threat, but we really don't know at this phase. It could potentially just be a semantics thing where someone, an individual hacked into their build server and changed the source code from there. I don't know if it means they had physical access or remote access.
We had a commenter essentially wondering about the same thing, whether there was some kind of a, perpetrator inside of SolarWinds or someone was bribed there. But it sounds like what you're saying is, Nicole, we just don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, we just don't know the answer to it. But isn't that interesting? I mean, that's something that we have been talking about for years, which is, your security is only as good as your weakest link. And often the weakest link are humans. And, this is something that we know the CIA has done in the past, go straight to a company or try to bribe an employee at the company or at the factory or an executive to try and place backdoor code into this technology. When they can't do that, we know that the U.S., and we've reported this before, intercept shipments when, a computer is being flown or device is being flown to an adversary they want to target. They've intercepted shipments en route. And so that's all the things I've learned for my book. But, we do that too. And it would be totally within the realm of possibility that something like that happened here. But we just don't know it yet.
We're almost up on a break here, but I'm just curious. In fact, something you wrote that it could take months, maybe even years, before President-elect Biden or anyone can really trust the system, the systems that were hacked. Can you quickly respond to that? I mean, how far in the future should we look to solve this? And I'm assuming there's going to be more data breaches and hacks coming fast and furious.
Right. The only sort of recent example that we can look to on this is the SVR's hack of the White House and State Department. And it was really difficult, according to the people who were working on getting them out, to get them out. In one case, I learned the SVR actually hacked into the security investigatory tool they used to find Russian backdoors on their networks and manipulated the tool so that it would not find other Russian implants. And so they would come in one day and assume they'd gotten the SVR out of their systems, only to find them crawl through a different door. And that is the big fear here, that, with the access they had, this wasn't just two agencies in this case. We're now talking about 40 agencies, potentially more than 150. And the question is, how can we trust these networks?
Sure. And I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Nicole Perlroth, our guest, will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, we're getting the latest on the Russian hack that's been called the largest act of espionage in U.S. history. Talking with the New York Times cybersecurity reporter Nicole Perlroth about what we know about what happened, what we don't know, what was likely stolen or compromised, how significant a national security threat the attack poses, and what to do about it. And again, she writes for the New York Times. She's got a forthcoming book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. Joining us by Skype now is Clint Watts. He's Distinguished Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is located in Philadelphia, a non-resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy, a national security contributor for NBC News and MSNBC, also the author of Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, also a former FBI special agent. Clint Watts, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me play another clip. I played an earlier one in the introduction to the show. This is President-elect Joe Biden. It's a video posted online yesterday where he's discussing the importance of cooperation between his and the Trump administration.
And right now, as our nation is in a period of transition, we need to make sure that nothing is lost in the handoff between administrations. My team needs a clear picture of our force posture around the world and our operations to deter our enemies. We need full visibility into the budget planning underway at the Defense Department and other agencies in order to avoid any window of confusion or catch-up that our adversaries may try to exploit. But as I said from the beginning, we have encountered roadblocks from the political leadership at the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget. Right now, We just aren't getting all the information that we need for the ongoing outgoing from the outgoing administration in key national security areas. It's nothing short, in my view, of irresponsibility.
Flint Watts, let me get a response from you. And I was talking with Nicole Perlroth about the President Trump's, not to his Secretary of State, but President Trump's response to this hack, basically blaming China, calling it a hoax. I mean, it's clear the administration is not doing much to address or even sound the alarm on this hack. What are the options facing the Biden administration as they come into office?
I think they're going to have a tough time, in part because the tools they consistently want to use are sanctions and diplomacy as their sort of carrots and sticks. And those have historically proven ineffective, particularly with the Russians and to a degree with the Chinese. I mean, diplomacy for the Russians oftentimes means times to reset while they plan their next operation. And so when we look through the cyber attacks over the last 3 to 4 years, when we look at election 2016 and our response to that, most of the sanctions are landing on oligarchs or mid-level managers, and it's not had any deterrent effect on Vladimir Putin and what he wants to do. And in some ways, it can be seen as an accelerant to what Putin wants to do, meaning he wants to bring Russians back under his control. He wants to bring Russian nationalism back under his control. And some of those maneuvers actually strengthen his grip, both financially, diplomatically, militarily, in terms of intelligence information, over his orbit. And so I think they've really got to reinvent a new way to try and show deterrence to Russia and to China, aside from the traditional, we won't use the military, or we won't use offensive cyber, or we won't really be aggressive in some of these other actions.
Nicole, we touched on this earlier, but you were saying, you know, the United States engages in this cyber warfare as well. Besides sanctions, diplomacy, are there options that the U.S. has or that President-elect Joe Biden will have in dealing with this cyber attack?
Well, I think Clint made a great point. You know, so far, our response has been sanctions, indictments, and they have not worked. So, you know, what the president-elect was saying the other day was that it's not just enough to improve our cybersecurity. We need to impose substantial costs on Russia, and that is what his administration planned to do in response to this attack. But the problem is, in cyber, any response often leads to an escalation. So really where we've seen this most clearly has been Iran. You know, we pulled off with Israel a spectacular attack on an Iranian nuclear facility that delayed their uranium enrichment by a couple years at minimum. That was a great short-term win for the United States mm-hmm. and Israel. But at the same time, it showed Iran and it showed other countries what could be done in cyberspace. And it was only a couple years later that Iran was able to start pulling off destructive attacks of its own on our allies in Saudi Arabia, on Saudi Aramco's networks, and also on banks here in the United States. And so that has been the lesson of cyberspace, that the enemy is a very good teacher. So if we were to respond with some sort of, let's say, destructive cyber attack of our own to inflict pain on Russia for this attack, we could likely expect the same in this kind of escalation. So it just makes the decision of how to calibrate a response to this attack very difficult, particularly, like I said, when we conduct some of similar operations.
Picking up on that, Clint Watts, so if that is true, which is, and it sounds like that is what has happened, is that when you respond, then the enemy learns about your response and then they escalate. Is it possible to de-escalate these cyber attacks in this world that we live in?
I think there is a way to do it. And I think there are examples from the past. For example, let's go back to the Cold War. If the Soviet Union pulled off a major intelligence operations inside the United States, right? Or did some sort of a peripheral attack against Americans. Our response wasn't to strategic bomb Moscow, right? And that's kind of how we've gotten ourselves into this framework of it can only be either or. But there are other places around the world where Russia is being really aggressive, or via private military companies, cyber operations on the periphery through oligarchs. We could. Two such places in particular are Africa and Latin America. While America has been fighting itself for the last 4 years, Russia, its oligarchs, its private military companies, the cyber operations have shown massive expansion in places where we used to have lots of influence. And so those are places where we could both do, I think, more offensive operations, or at least meet the challenge of Russia. And we could do it in ways that don't require us to expend our best weapons or our most advanced technology, just based in terms of the infrastructure that's used oftentimes in these locations, to send a signal that we are starting to mount a response and we are trying to develop some sort of deterrence over time.
I want to know, Nicole, we've been talking largely sort of government-to-government cyber attacks and response, but how much of the sort of cyber warfare world is really just an underground market of sort of freelancers and non-state actors?
Well, you know, here in the United States, any offensive cyber action is conducted by U.S. Cyber Command. It's different when you're just talking about espionage, but any kind of attack is conducted by Cyber Command. We don't freelance those operations. And in China and in Russia, that's not the case. You know, many, many times, a lot of the most sophisticated attacks that we have seen from China, for instance, have come through contractors who contract with the Ministry of State Security. Oftentimes, these are people who have day jobs at some of China's biggest technology companies. They're known as some of the country's best engineers, and they're tapped to sort of moonlight in some of these government espionage operations. Same thing with Russia. You know, we know that there is very much a friendly relationship between Russian cyber criminal groups and the state. You know, there's only two rules, they say, that Putin has, which is don't hack inside the motherland. And when we come and call in a favor, you must comply. It's part of the reason that ahead of the election, one of the things that Cyber Command did was they went and hacked into the infrastructure used by one of the biggest ransomware groups or distributors based in Russia, to say, hey, you know, sort of don't come for the election or we'll come for you. And they, together with some Microsoft moves in federal court, were successfully able to dismantle this infrastructure ahead of the election. So those are the things that we were doing ahead of the election because we were scared Russian cyber criminal groups potentially would interfere in 2020. And, you know, we just don't have the benefit here of being able to tap, you know, the best engineer at Microsoft or at Google or at Facebook and say, hey, come work for us at night. We just don't do that here. And it does in some ways put us at a strategic disadvantage because it makes it that much more imperative that we are able to recruit the most top talent to the NSA and to our cyber defense. And these days you can make a much better salary and in some cases do some of the same, you know, very interesting work in security-wise at some of these private companies.
Let me go back to you, Clint Watts. I mean, it sounds like you both are describing a kind of a whack-a-mole. So we were able to fix at least some of the threats from Russia coming from the 2016 election to the 2020 election. But I saw a tweet that you had in the last day or so that Russians are involved, or Russia is involved, in a vaccine disinformation campaign. Can you speak to that? This is a bit of a leap, but I just wanted to connect some of the dots here.
I think it's important to note that with all of the state-on-state propaganda disinformation that's out there, it's not solely tied to the election. And, you know, I'm partly to blame with that. That's what I've been working on for 4 years. But what has been remarkable to watch over the last 18 months is the convergence of all national interest vis-a-vis the U.S., focusing on every available issue and theme to sort of degrade the United States. So for Russia, maligning the United States for its COVID-19 response or trying to undermine confidence in the vaccine is an advance for them as they try and push their own vaccine and sell it overseas. and as they like to see us go down. It's a zero-sum game from the Kremlin's perspective. For Russia to go up, America must go down. This is consistent as well with the Chinese, and that goes to everything from vaccines to even what we've been talking about this last week, which is 5G technology. You know, sure. The country that can develop a vaccine quickly, the country that can develop 5G technology quickly, those are national strategic priorities, and whoever gets there first can win, so to speak, around the world. And so this enduring battle we've been thinking of disinformation, his move quickly on from election 2020 to vaccine disinformation, and it will continue on as we move forward.
Is there any, I feel embarrassed to use the word easy, but is there any easy or direct way to dispel disinformation, Clint?
Not while our current administration is in the White House. I mean, they also echo it and oftentimes parrot, you know, some of that same disinformation. I do think over time, America has gotten more resilient. The institutions have done much better in the last 2 years when you look at how they respond to the election. And so have the social media companies. They picked it up to a degree. Over time, I think the ultimate challenge to all of this is America doesn't really know what it is anymore or what it believes in a unified way. And so when I hear people often say, we've got to counter Russia on disinfo, or we've got to counter Chinese propaganda. And I say, well, what would you want to say back to them? And the message isn't very clear. And so we can't really punch back until America gets its feedback on the ground. And I do think that will happen over time. But it will take a lot of efforts on a lot of fronts to bring that together. It won't simply take an administration change. It will take Americans wanting to value Americans enough, and you know, rather than taking on information from afar.
Nicole, your forthcoming book is titled This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. As I mentioned earlier, that's quite a title. In 1 minute or less, what does that title refer to?
Well, you know, I joined the cybersecurity beat at the New York Times 10 years ago. Wow. And when I first got there, everyone I talked to would say, you know, we're in for, and they always called it at that time, a cyber 9/11 or a cyber Pearl Harbor, you know, some sort of cyber-induced kinetic event that would derail trains or cause an explosion of some kind. And I remember I would always ask them, so, okay, then how long do you, you know, when can we expect that? And they would almost comically say the same answer, which was 18 to 24 months. Oh, wow. And that has not happened yet,
no.
Thank God. But, you know, what has happened, I would argue, is something more akin to a plague, where we have been attacked through so many vectors, you know, ransomwareing, whole towns and cities, you know, the targeting of the vaccine supply chain, the disinformation, the increased sophistication of every attack, that it's not an explosion that's coming. It's more like, you know, the proverbial frog in boiling water, where we've normalized these attacks because they happen so often that we've sort of failed to look around and realize that we're boiled. And, you know, the Russian hack is just the latest. But I did want to just add one thing to what
sure,
Clint said about vaccine disinformation. So for my book, I went to Ukraine in the winter of 2019. And I was there
to
investigate.
Nicole, I hate to do this. We have about 40 seconds. But go ahead.
Oh,
sure. I'm interested.
No, I was just going to say, at the U.S. Embassy at that time, the number one thing they were dealing with was vaccine disinformation. Russia was going to Facebook groups belonging to young mothers and convincing them that vaccines were dangerous at that time for measles. And Ukraine, partly as a result, had some of the lowest vaccination rates in the world. So I'm very worried that they're already bringing some of that same strategy here.
I hate to leave it there, but I do appreciate both of you joining us on Radio Times. Nicole Perlroth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And she covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times. And again, a book coming out in February titled This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. Clint Watts, thank you for joining us as always on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Distinguished Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, non-resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy. He's the author of Messing with the Enemy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.